Hello, and welcome to Kirby Talks. Going to do something slightly different today. I'm rather than politics, I'm actually looking at a bit of history and particularly the Treaty of Versailles. So this is branching out, doing some historical stuff that might be for A-level, might be for GCSE, or you might just be listening to for a bit of fun. So the Treaty of Versailles, or the Paris Peace Conferences as a whole, were, if you don't already know, the series of treaties that were designed to officially end World War I in 1919, following the armistice that was signed at the end of on the 11th of November 1918. Now, the big three, although they're considered big four at the time, but the big three leaders who all gathered were Woodrow Wilson from America, David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and George Clemenceau, the Prime Minister of France. Now, that's quite unusual for a major peace conference to have the major leaders not just there to sign it, but to actually be there to negotiate it. And that's part of the problems Wilson would find with the whole treaty. But before we begin, let's have a think about the context of the Treaty of Versailles and what the aims of these leaders were. So, in 1916... Woodrow Wilson had actually won his second presidential election by promising to keep the USA out of the war, mainly because Americans weren't happy with the war. They didn't want to fight a European affair. But they also saw the conflict between Germany and Britain and France on the other side as a conflict of empires. And something the Americans didn't like was the concept of empire, having freed themselves from British rule back in the American War of Independence. So the Americans didn't like this idea. It's also worth bearing in mind that a key constituency in Germany were the German immigrants who'd settled there in the late 19th century in quite large numbers. So Woodrow Wilson had campaigned as a defender of peace and with the idea that he would keep them out of the war. So obviously the fact that America then gets dragged into the war a year later puts pressure on him. He has to justify his decision. And in negotiating the peace, he has to show that he wants to keep America out of future wars and maintain peace. So he's in a difficult position with the folks back home. In 1918, David Lloyd George had won re-election in the UK by promising to be tough on Germany and to protect the empire. So whereas Wilson is coming in with this view of keeping America in peace and of preventing future wars, and from a very empire, anti-empire position, Lloyd George is coming in with a clear focus to punish Germany and to protect the British Empire at all costs. So they've got very different priorities. In 1917, Georges Clemenceau had come to power in France by promising to make Germany pay and to destroy the threat of Germany and to protect France. And it's worth bearing in mind that Germany had invaded France before in 1870. That's where, in the Franco-Prussian War, the Germans had humiliated the French and basically rolled through them. And that's where they'd acquired the territory of Alsace and Lorraine. So the fact that they then got invaded again in 1914 kind of explains why the French were so fearful of future Germans' attacks and why they wanted to ensure they would be safe again. It wasn't a one-off thing for them. Now, from the other side, Germany had, of course, signed the armistice, but although they were in a weak position, hadn't actually been defeated in the war. So that's going to mean the Germans are looking at this more as an agreement between the powers rather than entering it as a defeated power. So it's very different from World War II, where Germany was actually clearly defeated in the war. They'd been invaded and Berlin was captured. The other thing that's really important to remember for the whole context is what had happened in 1917. 1917 is the date, rolls into 1918, but go with 17. In 1917, Germany had forced Russia to sign a really restrictive treaty, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Now, the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin at the time, were trying to assert their control and just stop the conflict. So we're desperate at all costs to get out of the war. And the Germans exploited this. They took a huge, huge amount of the good European fertile territory, places like Ukraine, a lot of modern day Poland, Belarus as well. They took that territory. They took a huge chunk of the Russian population, huge amounts of equipment, machinery, all the industrial bits, which really crippled Russia. So, of course, the Germans have themselves been incredibly restrictive and harsh in negotiating a peace treaty on someone who they hadn't defeated, but who needed to stop fighting in the war. So, again, when there's calls about German unfairness in the treaty, a lot of people will turn around and say, well, hang on, look at what you did to Russia. Surely this justifies what Britain, France, America and Italy did. The other thing to remember is that before the war, Germany had been the UK's biggest single trading partner, as well as their main rival. So from a British point of view, they don't want Germany to come across as a new rival, but they want to re-establish that German trade for their own benefit. So you shouldn't look just at the Treaty of Versailles as a one-off incident. You've got to think about the context and all these ideas and where they came from. And particularly the three main leaders had all won elections by promising very different things. And that the Germans had themselves got their own attitudes and problems. So the key ideas of the big three were as follows. Woodrow Wilson comes in with the aim of not being too harsh on Germany. He believes that a harsh, restrictive, punitive treaty that takes a lot off them and punishes them will be humiliating and will lead to a future conflict. In his 14-point speech, he'd outlined a number of key principles that he wanted to see enshrined in the treaty. Now, the 14-point speech was in many ways a mistake by Wilson. He issues this in public, kind of suggesting that this is what he will get from the treaty. And it builds up hope and expectation from everyone, from Americans, but also from the defeated countries. But of course, in the process of the negotiations, he's going to have to compromise. So by setting out his stall, he's setting himself up for a fall, which is what happens later. But amongst those promises was this idea of national self-determination, that people of a particular national identity, however that might be defined, should rule themselves, should determine their own fate. So the Poles should be ruled by Poles, and Germans should be ruled by Germans, Hungarians by Hungarians, Austrians by Austrians, Bulgarians by Bulgarians, which is a lovely idea. But of course, in practice, it was harder to determine which bits were German speakers or German territory and what was Polish territory, what was French, what was actually German, because people don't live in nice little boxes. He also wanted to promote the concept of democracy, which is obviously an important idea in America. And again, the Americans at the time had this huge fear of communism and socialism in general, and they viewed the newly Bolshevik and communist Russia as a far greater threat than German militarism, and that's going to play a role in their fear. He wants to encourage international cooperation by creating the League of Nations in order to promote peace and to avoid future wars. So he's identified the problems that existed in the run-up to World War One, and he wants to remove those problems by getting countries talking to each other. Now, David Lloyd George, he goes in, he wants to keep Germany as a strong trading partner. So he doesn't want Germany to be crippled either, but he's got this problem of promising to punish Germany in the background. Of course, his big goal is to enlarge and protect the British Empire. So he's eyeing up not just the German territory, but the Ottoman territory and any other overseas colonies by defeated powers that the British might be able to take and make part of their own empire. And he's going to try and promote He's trying to promote the best interest for the British Empire as a whole. Like Wilson, he has a great fear of communism and socialism, but he's torn between what he thinks will be in the best interest, keeping Germany strong enough to trade with Britain, but also pleasing the British people who want revenge and they want to punish Germany for the war. And of course, his instinct is always to protect Britain. Now, Clemenceau, slightly different, and obviously the reason for that is because of the experience France had. Although Britain had lost a lot of men, France had lost a lot more, and a lot of the fighting was on their territory in neighbouring Belgium. Plus, the history of being invaded by Germany before. So Clemenceau comes in. He wants to make Germany pay for the full cost of the war. He goes in demanding 200 million gold francs, which is a huge amount more than the 6.6 billion pounds the treaty will eventually determine. He also wants to ensure Germany would never again attack France. He wants to cripple it. Now, the president, Poincaré at the time, I think it was Poincaré, I'll need to check that. Anyway, the French president at the time had this idea of breaking Germany up into the smaller states like the old Holy Roman Empire. It's worth bearing in mind, Germany had only recently become one unified country under Prussian dominance. So the idea was to weaken Germany again by breaking it into the smaller states like Saxony and Bavaria. Clemenceau knew that probably wouldn't gain any traction, but he certainly wants to weaken Germany enough to make sure it can never threaten France again. So, compromises. Where do they compromise? What do they do? And why do they do them? First of all, there's a compromise that Germany would be allowed a small military force. The 100,000 men, 6 battleships, no submarines, no air force, but enough of a military force to defend itself, mostly to defend itself from the USSR. This is what Britain and America want. They fear the communists from the USSR might, in the future, roll through Europe, clean sweep and just take off Germany and go straight for France. And there wouldn't be anything to do about it. 100,000 men, they believe, would be enough for the Germans to defend themselves, though not enough to become an aggressive force. So you see the fear of communism playing a role. However, to please Clemenceau and the French, or to appease them in some ways, they agreed that the Rhineland bordering France would be made a demilitarized zone. So the Germans could have 100,000 men to defend from Soviet attack, but they wouldn't be able to put them anywhere near France. So that's a key compromise. They agreed that key bits of territory would be taken off Germany to create new states for self-determining nations. Upper Schleswig would be able to choose whether it went to Denmark or stayed with Germany. Upper Silesia and other parts of Poland would be able to determine whether they went Polish or German. And other territories would determine French allegiance or Belgium, so on. Enough to weaken Germany and make them less of a threat to France, but also fulfilling Wilson's goal of self-determination for those people and keeping Germany one solid nation rather than breaking up, which would allow them to remain a strong trading partner with Britain. Again, compromise and nod to democracy. Some of these areas would be allowed a plebiscite, kind of like a referendum over national sovereignty to determine which country they would go to. So the people would turn up and vote and decide if they wanted to be Polish or German or whatever nation they happen to be in. It was agreed that Germany would pay reparations for the cost of the war, but because they couldn't agree on exactly how much Germany should pay, the figure was determined to be set later. And that's important to remember, particularly if you look at any of the sources at the time. There was a lot of fear from Germany because they didn't know how much they were being told they'd have to pay. Effectively, they were signing the treaty like signing a blank check. And they were anxious and worried about this. And this is why they don't start paying the Treaty of Versailles until 1921, because, well, until 1921, they don't know how much it is they're going to have to do. So there would be a process of a review to work out Germany's cost. Again, the compromise was that all future conflicts would be resolved by a League of Nations, and that would be set up as a key part of it. And as a compromise with the Germans, or for German territory, the German colonies, not that there were that many, but German colonies in Africa and elsewhere would be run as mandates by the League of Nations. So the idea there was this was America not wanting to benefit empires. German territory wouldn't be given directly to Britain and France as victor's spoils. However, because Britain and France end up controlling the League, they effectively control the mandate. So it's a compromise, but Britain and France effectively end up controlling them. And of course, from an African point of view, or a colonial point of view, there was a question mark over, well, what does this mean for national self-determination? And obviously, Woodrow Wilson's vision of self-determination was for white, European, westernized nations it didn't really concern African and Asian colonies who would have to remain subject to European rule. Now, another key term is the war guilt clause, that Germany would have to accept full responsibility for starting the war. Now, the reason why this was so important was without it, the rest couldn't be justified. If Germany didn't acknowledge that they carried all the guilt, then it was hard to make them pay for the cost of the war and to put such a punitive treaty on them. Now, this was a source of huge anger in Germany because they felt, well, they didn't start the war. Obviously, it started with the conflict in the Balkans. Russia had played their goal. And of course, although Germany had invaded France and Belgium, Britain and France had also played their role in the conflict, in escalating it and building the trenches and so on. So while they probably would have accepted some sense of responsibility, the fact that they were made to take responsibility for the whole thing was a great source of anger to the Germans, but it was important for the Allies in order to justify the harshness of the terms. Now, the reparations, the idea was that they would be paying for the damage, but they weren't meant to be a punishment on their own. So it was just going to be for the costs. So Germany would have to pay the cost of the war. That's why it's so much less than the 200 million gold francs Clemenceau was initially demanding. Now, what exactly the cost of the war meant was not agreed until 1921. And it certainly was huge, £6.6 billion set at the time. That was a huge sum, particularly for a government that had just lost most of its industry and key bits of its population through the loss of territory as well as its empire. But again, and this is part of the conflict, for all the harshness that the Germans complained about at the time, compare it to Brest-Litovsk. Was it any worse or harsher than the payments that they forced and the economic sanctions they put on the Russians at the time? The answer is probably not, which meant there was a lack of sympathy to German outrage at the treaty, rightly or wrongly. It's worth bearing in mind that most of, well, all the territory that Germany got from Brest-Litovsk was either made into independent states like Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia, or given back to the Soviet Union because it couldn't be administered. Now, from a German point of view, they're going to argue they hadn't done all the damage. Obviously, a lot of the shells and mines were launched by the French and British. And again, nor had the Germans been defeated. But from a French point of view, they argued Germany should be paying full compensation for the sort of emotional damage and the trauma and as a punishment, as well as the pure costs. The fact that it is just the costs is kind of a compromise between the British and American position and the French position. It certainly was harsh. Should it or could it have been harsher? The French think so. The Germans obviously didn't. Now, key German territories, so land loss that's worth knowing. Nordschleswig did vote. I think I said Upper Schleswig earlier, but Nordschleswig, excuse my pronunciation, would go to Denmark following the result of a plebiscite, so the people got to choose. The territories of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania were created out of those Russian losses to Germany in 1918, so from the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, and allowed to rule their own affairs, which is something they'd been moving towards, even though they'd been territories part of Russia for a couple of hundred years, yeah, more than 200 years. The Saarland, which is near France and a huge industrial area with lots of coal fields, that was going to be run by the League of Nations. And then after 15 years, there would be a plebiscite to decide if they wanted to return to Germany or not. And that will coincide with Hitler's rise to power. Alsace and Lorraine were to be returned to France. And again, there's an interesting point there. Obviously, that was territory that the Germans had captured from France back in 1870, but there was no plebiscite there was no choice. So a lot of German speakers, or there were people of German origin, had settled there and lived in the territories of Alsace and Lorraine. They weren't allowed to determine their own future, so there's going to be some resentment at the failure to give them national self-determination there. West Prussia, Posen and Upper Silesia were all given to Poland. And again, this was just done by diktat. They weren't initially done by plebiscite or vote. And West Prussia, Posen and Upper Silesia had all been, to varying degrees, part of Germany for a long time, part of the Holy Roman Empire, with huge Germanic traditions. So, you know, West Prussia was a fundamental part of Prussia, had been for years. So there's a resentment that will come through there, which will lead to a future plebiscite. Danzig, which is now Gdansk, that would be a free city run by the League with a view of giving Poland and Germany access to a major port. So East Prussia, which became separate from West Prussia, well, West Prussia was taken off them, but separate from the rest of Germany, would be able to use the port of Danzig, as would Poland. No one city would control it. Which is fine in principle, but it only works if the League is able to operate effectively and control it, which, as you probably know, or will find out about in due course, it didn't. The League just didn't really work. And, of course, the German territories overseas were to be given to the League as mandates. Now, what about the armed forces? I've mentioned a few of these already, but key things to know. The army would be limited to 100,000 men. Again, that's a defence force, and that's with a view to the USSR. Conscription was banned, so they could only be volunteers. You couldn't force people into the military, as had happened before. There'd be no tanks, submarines or aircraft. The advanced warfare machinery that would give you a big advantage in attack. The Navy was limited to 6 battleships as well as smaller ships, enough to defend North German ports and the Baltic from potential Soviet aggression. The Rhineland would become a demilitarized zone. All of this is enough to ensure it could act as a defense force against a possible USSR invasion, but not enough to wage an aggressive war. And the buffer was introduced to protect France. So we see the compromises coming through. As for the League of Nations, its aim was to keep peace among member states, but with Germany not being allowed to join, the USSR not being invited to join, and the USA refusing to join, 3 of the key international players at the time aren't there, and the League can only be effective if it's got the members. If Germany, USSR and USA aren't there, they can't be used to enforce it, but nor can they be sanctioned by the League. So, seems an odd one. We're going to keep peace, but Germany's been so naughty in declaring wars, we're not going to allow them to join the League where we could keep an eye on them. It's a bit of a contradiction, and it's one of the early flaws in the League. Now, to do a quick review, how did the Big Three view this treaty? Well, Wilson was pleased with the self-determination in Eastern Europe. He liked the fact that new democratic governments were created in Germany, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia and so on. Happy with the League of Nations being created. Pleased with Germany remaining one state. Quite happy that there's a buffer in the state of Germany from communist threats. And very happy with the principle of German disarmament. Lloyd George is very pleased with Germany paying reparations for the cost of the war. Happy that Germany remains a potential trading partner and will be good for the British economy. Very happy that Germany loses its overseas empire. Very happy that the German military is weakened and therefore can't threaten British interests. And again, happy for Germany to be a buffer zone against communism. Clemenceau, for his part, is very happy with Germany paying reparations. He's happy that Germany has been at least reduced in size, content with the Rhineland buffer zone, and of course for the return of Alsace and Lorraine to German control. However, on the negative ledger, Wilson was unhappy with the limitations on self-determination, the fact that some territories hadn't been able to have a vote, that it hadn't quite worked for all countries, wasn't pleased that no other country was required to disarm. Yes, the defeated powers were, but there was no requirement for Britain and France to disarm, therefore his goal of disarmament was unlikely to be met. Obviously, Britain and France and other empires remained, which is against his beliefs. He felt that it was too much of a humiliation of Germany, which would lead to future conflicts. And he wasn't happy that Germany was being made to pay for the costs of war on its own or with some of the other defeated nations. Lloyd George wasn't that happy over the failure to gain the overseas territories for Britain. Obviously, he had an eye on them for the British Empire. Wasn't pleased that key industrial areas of Germany were lost, because that's going to affect their ability to trade with him, with Britain. And of course, the whole concept of self-determination raises issues for the British Empire, particularly in countries like India, but Canada, Australia as well, that are looking to go increasingly independent. So the whole concept of it wasn't great from a British Empire point of view. Clemenceau, not happy that Germany still has a military. Not that content that it still remains a single country and potential threat to French interests. Not happy that France didn't gain direct control of overseas territories for itself. The Saar region, he'd hoped would go to France, but instead it's being run by the League, not by France. And just as for Britain, issues of self-determination raise problems for the French Empire overseas in places like French Indochina, Cambodia, Vietnam and Laos, many of their overseas colonies, particularly in North Africa, where there are growing nationalistic movements. From the German point of view, they saw the treaty as incredibly unfair. They were being blamed for everything and made to pay for everything, which they felt was unjust. The fact that they were the only ones of the major powers that had to disarm, despite Wilson's 14-point speech promising all countries would disarm, they felt it was a humiliation. The fact that they weren't invited to even attend the negotiations and put their view meant they felt it was a dictated treaty that was imposed on them from on high. The Germans had suffered huge military losses themselves that weren't accounted for. Germany lost out to new countries. Despite self-determination, lots of Germans had now found themselves living in other states like Poland, which is going to form a lot of the resentment that will lead to the Nazis gaining power, as they appeal to German speakers. And of course, not being invited to join the League adds to that humiliation. And economically, they lose these key areas like the Saar coalfields and key parts of their population. It's that irony. They're made to pay for the cost of the war, but they lost the means to raise money to pay for that. So it's kind of a double blow for the Germans. The impact on Germany, in the long run, we see a rise of political violence, initially from the Kapp Putsch, which was a right-wing goal about the humiliation. And then a few years later, we get the Munich Putsch in 23. Again, right-wing groups that feel the treaty was a humiliation and they've been betrayed by the November criminals and the Dolchstoss-Serie, the stabbed in the back. The Ruhr Valley, when Germany refuses or is unable to pay its second lot of reparations, the French come in and basically occupy the Ruhr Valley, the key industrial area that's left to Germany. The only answer that the German government has, is to go on strike, which means then they're not making any money. So then they just jack up inflation by printing more and more money to meet short-term debts, to pay workers and so on. And that just leads to a cycle of hyperinflation, all of which is a disaster for Germany. This whole mess that happens in the early years happens at the very same time that Germany is trying to establish a new system of government. It's trying to introduce democracy and democratic leaders accountable to the people. However, all this humiliation, all these problems just leads to resentment towards the leaders and the very concept of democracy. The Germans don't take to it in these years because they associate it with failure, weakness and humiliation. There's also grown anger towards the Allies, particularly Britain and France, for the humiliation at the treaty. And that's going to lead to increased hostility as people go through. They make themselves long-term enemies. And of course, there's German humiliation and embarrassment at the way they've been treated, which will turn into German nationalism, which of course those right-wing parties will eventually be able to exploit. Now, just a quick note on the other territories. In Saint-Germain, Austria was dealt with. That the key terms were a restriction of the army to 30,000 men. They weren't allowed Anschluss or union with Germany, and their whole empire was broken up. This causes such economic turmoil that they basically never have to pay any reparations, even though they were supposed to. Treaty of Neuilly, which dealt with Bulgaria, they lost land to Greece, Romania and Yugoslavia as part of national self-determination. Army limited to 20,000 men. They were ordered to pay reparations of £100 million, which is a lot less than Germany had, but equally, this was seriously damaging to their economy. Trianon dealt with Hungary, and again, Hungary is difficult because it was the nation of Austria-Hungary, led by the Austrian Empire. And so Hungary felt they were a new nation, but they were being judged as an old nation. Anyway, they lost territory to Romania, Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. Reparations were imposed, but they could never be paid because Hungary, like Austria, was just in such a mess after the war. And then initially, the Treaty of Sèvres, which dealt with Turkey, That lost European land to Bulgaria, Italy, and Greece, plus all its Arab empire, which had risen up against it during the war, was taken away to be controlled by the League as mandates. The whole, well, huge territory of Arabia was given to the Saud royal family, hence Saudi Arabia. Turkey would be limited to 50,000 men, a limited navy, again, enough to defend the Bosphorus and access to the Mediterranean from a potential USSR attack, and no air force. Although a lot of these terms would be amended in the Treaty of Lausanne a few years later after a Turkish uprising. Now, just to round this off, because I've been going for half an hour, the key things to remember if you're learning these for a GCSE exam is to try and make sure you know four key terms for each of the treaties and for each of the subterms of the Treaty of Versailles. Make sure you know four key examples of each big area of the Treaty of Versailles. Think about wins and losses for each of the big three, what they gained and what they had to compromise on and what they would have resented. Think about why Germany was angry and how justified it was. Try and think about the context that motivated the big three. It wasn't just their personal opinions. Where had these opinions been formed and how were they justified? And try and think about the overall fairness of each treaty on its own merits, in relation to the victorious powers, but also in relation to each other. Was Germany more harshly treated than the other defeated powers? And it's always worth thinking about what the concept of fairness actually means. Did Germany deserve an extra harsh punishment, or should all the defeated powers have been treated the same way? There's no easy answer for that, but I would say these are the key ideas to think about when considering the Treaty of Versailles and its legacy. So, not politics, but history here, with a focus for the GCSE or IGCSE courses that people may be sitting as revision, whatever it is. Maybe you found it interesting, maybe you think this was not for you at all. And if you did think that, I do apologise. But hopefully you got something out of it, and I will do some more of these on other 20th century history bits, as well as some other more advanced stuff for A-level and beyond, as well as coming back to some politics. Thank you very much, and I'll do one of these again soon. Bye.